Bonnie Gani, everyone. This is Professor Amin Ra, Professor Emeritus, California State University of Long Beach Africana Studies Department, former member of the Compton Unified School District Board of Trustees, the Compton College Board of Trustees, and Compton City Council. Also, retired professor from Compton Community College, where I taught ethnic studies, psychology, as well as history. African-American history. I want to welcome you to the Conscious Corner. Joining me is historian Joe Hembrick, one of the foremost educators and taught in Linwood Unified School District, as well as Compton Unified School District, as well as coach, one of the most successful coaches, not only coaching the persons in the sports, but coaching them in life, as well as an outstanding administrator at Centennial High School, Davis, and just a good brother in the community that is well respected, well admired for his knowledge in independent studies and development in African history, especially ancient African history. We want to welcome all of you to the show tonight. This is our community forum night, where we're going to discuss major issues that the African-American community has been going through and the challenges that they face. There's a number of topics, you know, the Ahmaud Arbery case and what it's about right now and his parents. We want to also talk about Travis Scott and the Astroworld concert where 8 people died. And we also want to talk about the Irving with the New York Nets, Kyrie Irving, and him not getting the shot, and the psychological aspect and influence it may have on other young people. And we want to also talk about should children get the vaccine that they've approved. And Joe, did you want to add any other highlights that we need to discuss that you've seen?
No, sir. The Aubrey thing is, that's what I was going to mention. That was it.
All right, then. All right, let's get it on. Doc, you have any issues you think we need to discuss?
No, not right now.
Okay. Well, listen, you know, we got to start with Kaepernick. And get some, did you watch some more of it or re-watch any of it, Doc?
Oh yeah, I watched the whole series.
Okay,
the whole series.
So did you get a broader understanding or some things that you didn't mention last time that you saw?
No, it's about the same. It's a very interesting story about him growing up. The little issues he had dealing with race, you know, and this, like I said, you know, Brother Hembrick got that one thing pinned on me, know thyself. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what he was doing, know thyself, man. He was entering that stages where he was seeing things from that, you know, Black point of view. So it's very, very interesting story.
But what do you think about his choice not to go and sign the baseball contract and just hold out to football?
Like it's in the movie, man, a little documentary, you know, his passion was football. It wasn't baseball, you know. So that's basically what he just stuck to his passion. I think that's one of the messages, you know, stick to your passion. Don't go what everybody else wants you to be. If you don't want to be it.
Yeah. Two things stood out for me in the documentary was that his parents seemed to be his savior, and his friend, the white friend who wouldn't let him get involved in the car selling the car parts and stuff, you know, wouldn't let him hang out with him. What'd you think about that, Doc? You know, portraying whites is the savior.
Like I said, I don't see that as portraying as a savior. I look at it as, well, you know, he's in an all-white area. So you're going to have kids in, you know, an all-white area doing the same thing as kids doing an all-black area. This white kid was going around jacking cars, jacking, you know, trucks for tires and doing little side stuff. And same thing as, you know, as in the black neighborhood, Latino neighborhood, any other neighborhood. You know, you got those kids, you got the trade.
But the subliminal,
that's the way I see it, yeah.
The subliminal suggestion was that the white kid said, the reason I don't let you hang out with me and do these things is because I'd get shot doing what I'm doing with a black person. Did you get that part down?
Yeah, I remember seeing that part, but like I said, you pointed out he would stand out. If he's doing something, you know, criminal, they definitely would stand out, being the only black kid in town. He basically was telling, hey, you hanging out with me, everyone knows you hang out with me. If I go commit a crime, you're the only black kid in town, everybody gonna know it's me. You know, that's the way I saw it.
You know, when I went to Centennial in 10th grade, Aaron Wade was the coach. And in those days, we wore a hair, what we call a fluff. I don't know if y'all remember fluff. You know, you put Murray's on the side, you know, it's a white boy style haircut. We didn't know that. We just called it a fluff. Some people used to put peroxide in the front. But Wade said that if you're going to play football, you have to cut your hair. And so, you know, I played, I was going to play, but I left because he wanted us to wear Corvallises. And that reminded me of what Kamenik was going through when he got his braids and his parents made him cut his hair because the white coach said that he couldn't wear his hair that way with the braids. It made him look like a thug, and then he defined what thug was. You remember that, Doc?
Yeah, definitely remember that, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't that they didn't like the hairdo, it's just that the image was that he was a thug. And, you know, in Harry Edwards' book, grooming was a part of the aesthetics of sports at one time. And maybe Joe can tell us about the history of some of that. Patriot and being a patriot and being a Christian, because they had the prayer before the games. And then clean cut, you know. Joe, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, basically, we came down with that, with the wild hair and all of that. They taught us it was a safety precaution because the helmet needs to fit a certain way. If you got a whole lot of hair, or if you got braids, it creates pressure points in your head. So if you get hit a certain way, it could be damaging to your brain. That's what they told us. But we had a cat at Compton High play basketball. I'm like, he was the Dr. J in high school. His name was Chris Hill. I don't know if you ever heard of Chris. Chris had one of them big old Dr. J fros. He was the Dr. J fanatic. He was shooting trades before the trade came out. And he could jump out the gym and palm the ball. And Armstrong didn't let him play much because of the haircut thing. But he got to cut down a little bit. But, he wouldn't cut his hair off. But that's what they told us in football, that it was a safety thing. And if you got a lot of hair or you got braids all in your hair, it could cause you to get hurt because they was teaching to hit with the head back in them days, which is illegal today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that this, you know, the dynamics that he went through in the beginning, showing the highlights of auctioning slaves and people bidding on slaves like they bid on athletes. And his challenge as far as a pro athlete, I mean, a baseball player, and the challenges he went through as a young man coming up in a mixed family, and how when he went to the hotels, they thought he was not with the family, his mother and father, and then the police pulling them over for driving. When his daddy drove, you know, they made a point of his father driving to school, and his mother, the police never stopped him, the motorcycle car. As soon as they let him drive, they pulled him over. So there were some subtle subliminal suggestions and influence that came out. But at the same time, you know, the major role of they had the demonization with the white coaches that told him he couldn't play quarterback, even though he outplayed the white boy that they chose to be the quarterback throughout his 10th grade and 11th grade year. I don't think they let him play quarterback almost till his senior year, but you know, he was a great baseball player and they offered to draft him, and he chose that. He said his passion was football. And I don't know, and that's because I think that they didn't say this, but because he's in a family and he was stable and he wasn't hungry. Most young kids, if they were from the community or grew up, let's say for instance in Palm Lane, the projects and stuff, and they're a great athlete and the guy coming off some money, you take it. But he didn't have to because of his situation. That's, what do you think about that, Doc?
That's a good point, but you just brought up something earlier about the hair. I just want to ask you a quick question on that. Why is our hairstyle, hairdo, is so intimidating to whites? Because I remember when I first shaved my head back in the early 80s, or mid 80s when I was working, late 80s, I was at my employer. It intimidated a lot of people. And, you know, like you just said here, we saw him with the braids and even with the afro. Why do whites get intimidated by our hairstyles? I don't get that.
Well, I think
there's a
lot.
One of the European alumni, Bob Six, who owned American Airlines, had the security. They were called National Event Service way back in the day. And I remember when we used to work concerts and it was black, you know, they let us be a little more physical with the crowd. If we had to be, we could wear our hair anytime, any kind of way we wanted to. But when it was a white concert that we worked, we could not wear our braids. The guy was a supervisor who was a brother also. Well, he was black. I wouldn't call him a brother. Matter of fact, he's an actor today. His name is Eugene Clark. He was one of the guys sitting at the bar when they showed the movie Talk to Me, when the program director was sitting there at the bar and he was listening to these brothers talking. He's one of those guys. And he would make us take our braids and stuff out if we wanted to get paid. I don't know what it is, but Europeans suffer from what they call xenophobia. And anybody that's different from the way they look, they got a problem with it. And that's what it extends from. But as far as the hair thing, you know, brothers got hair reaching up to the sun, reaching up to Ra. And that European hair is laying down like a dog, like Malcolm said. You got poodles, German shepherds, collies, all that. But they all, I'm kind of getting off the point though, but yeah, they just, anything different from them, they have an issue with it. That's just what they suffer from. sister named Narembe Anai, one of Dr. Clark's students. He wrote this book for a doctor dissertation, and it's called Urugu. And she goes over all the psychological issues that they have as far as that stuff goes with anybody that looks different from them.
There's a number of reasons, Doc, and I agree with Joe. I appreciate what he said, if I understand correctly, and he's correct about that. You know, it's about control of especially Black athletes. And at the same time, you know, you get that military perspective where they make you cut your hair. And it's called the American look, clean cut, clean shaven. They even didn't want you to have beards when we was coming up. Mustache you might could get away with, but they didn't want you to have a goatee or nothing in high school or something like that. They always wanted you to shave. They want, you know, most of our hairstyles were just like women had to straighten their hair. Many Black men straighten their hair with conch, Marys, you wearing scarves and what they call Marseilles and processes. Straightening out your hair to look like long stringy hair. Just like what you see today, one of the highest projections that makes of oppressive, the flattery of to that white folks are flattered when you, it's a complimentary flattery for them, for you to look like them, wear your hair their way. And so you see a lot of Black people getting extensions on their hair. Even the athletes are getting extension on their braids. And and that makes it more acceptable to a certain degree. But at the same time, because we used to call them African cornrows, took it out of the European perspective. Then we went to Covadas, it's not bald yet. But at the same time, the whole thing is to exercise control and discipline, to put you through a psychological change that if you want to play like they was doing Colmenac, you have to do what I say and look the way I want you to look. I want a clean cut American look out there on the field, on the baseball diamond, especially in baseball, because baseball is what they call the number one family sport because it's affordable. And second, it's they called it the American sport. Even though it could be argued that they stole it from cricket and a bunch of other stuff and then put in their own rules, but same thing with football. You know, football is really soccer, but the European changed the rules and made it football, American football. But the point is that it's all about, not only do they want you to cut your hair and things of this nature, they want you to also be clean shaven. And that's the American look. But when you, as a Black person, did what Iverson, and they pointed out how Iverson sort of revolutionized the hairstyles and tattoos by saying he don't want to be like Michael Jordan and he don't want to be like Magic, he wanted to be himself. And that sort of liberated other athletes to start, you know, doing the tattoo thing and doing the braids and doing the other form of haircuts. And so, and then white boys started doing, you know, and that's what Kwame Ture said, that the his Black power movement liberated white folks so that they could grow their hair long and do their thing, you know, even though they were doing it in motorcycle clubs as well as Blacks doing their thing. But anyway, it's what Joe said, you know, it's the flattery of oppression. and control. It had nothing to do with safety. Just this is what we think will sell tickets, and that people who buy season tickets do not want to see Black people out there doing their own thing and looking there. You know, natural ways. It's like one of our struggles is to free ourselves, to be ourselves. It's like going to a job and having to wear a suit. I remember I went when I first got hired at Linwood, the lady didn't hire me because I wore dashiki to the interview. And she told the superintendent, Miss Charlie Knight, that, you know, because I knew Charlie Knight. She had been on a couple of programs where I spoke. She wanted me to be hired. So this principal said, well, he came, he didn't have a tie on. And she said, you go hire him anyway, you know. And so, but I had on over a $250 African suit. It wasn't like it was some dashiki you get off the rack, you know, standard. It was, you know, it was custom made, you know, at that time, and the lady wouldn't hire me. So how many Black people, when they go to interviews, have to put on, and this is what they said, you know, Black skin, white face, you know, Black mask, and all of that, fans for none. And you know, and as Dr. Ben said, we as Black people have to walk around with a bag full of different personalities for different situations. We have to have the proper personality, as Roski was saying that last week about when the police stop us. We have to have a personality when we go to work. We have to have a personality when we're sitting in school. You know, but as far as being able to be yourself, wear your African attire, wear your hairstyle to reflect your culture, they don't want that. That's too much liberation. And it shows a lack of control. They like for us to name our children after them. You know, I mean, that's how they gauge that they still, even though you may be exercising some rights, they still have control of you because you are still naming your children after the slave masters, and you also dressing like them and you know, using professional artists and news commentators as a measure of your ability to speak English, the proper English, you know, no Ebonics, you know, we want you to speak proper English. So it has a lot to do with racism, Doc. That's the point that me and Joe is trying to make. You know, that's a part of racism, suppression of your culture and your identity. I don't think they're intimidated or afraid of it. From the standpoint of the hair, they're afraid that what it leads to with regard to a victorious consciousness and a liberated consciousness, freeing yourself to be yourself. Because one Black historian said, pets and slaves are named by their masters. Free men name themselves. And so it goes into a lot of that. But now you see Muhammad, Kwame's all, you know, before when we was coming up and playing football, basketball, you didn't have brothers playing with Muslim name, but that's because parents named them that, and that's their official name. Before, people changed their name, but no, this is birth name. So it's a whole new different thing. Even though they may not be Muslim, they have a Muslim name. And you can argue if that's the right name, but when you have an African name, that's even more significant, Doc. Any response?
Okay, now, you know what? You brought up another point. let me ask you this. Yeah. You talk about where you wore your dashiki there. I mean, that's another personal thing. How much of your dignity or self-pride should you kind of like give up to get that position, the interview? You wore your dashiki. You didn't want to wear suit and tie. But as you know, like I said, being Black going on interviews, job promotions, and stuff. How far should you bow down to get that position when you know it's not you? You know, like I said, wearing a shirt and a tie. Is there a mere level? Or is it just the individual?
It depends on how bad you need the job. That was my second job. I already had a full professorship. So I was just picking up some more money. So, she didn't do it. I can go do something else. But the point is that it's like this principal name was Audrey Clark. And she, you know, she just old school from her standpoint. She wanted men in ties and suits. And there are a lot of Black people like that. Like Joe was talking about the security guy. You know, they come up that way. And that's their value system. You have to choose to be African, but you're American by habit, as we teach in Coweta. You know, I mean, these are habitual behaviors. We all have contradictions. You know, I mean, I have suits and ties. I can wear suits and ties, but I like being African, you know? And I didn't know she would be offended or thought that that was wrong, because at that time, then we was pretty much 50-50 Black or even more. And I'm in the Black movement. And I'm thinking that is okay. But, you know, she didn't hire me. But Miss Charlie Knight, who was the superintendent, told her to hire me. And so she hired me. And then when I got into the job, they loved me because I was on the LOC. I handled all the discipline kids. And I didn't have no problems. And I put on a Black History Month for them and did my thing. You know, I loved that, but everybody's not in the same position I was in. You know, I mean, when you secure and, you know, you got money coming in and you can do things. Some Black people who have money choose not to because they want more money, or they just don't have a Black consciousness. But if you have a Black consciousness, you know, you don't even think that what you're wearing is intimidating, because I'm in a Black community, Black people. So, you know, it's not like I went to an all white place wearing it. You know, I'm in the community. I'm in Linwood, I'm in Compton, in Centennial. And so, but did you have Black people like Wade and all of them and impose white values on us, you know?
Right. Well, if I could interject something here right here, because I knew Audrey Clark personally.
Mm-hmm.
She was the principal at one time when I was at Linwood. And, at first I was in Compton. I was determined to come to Compton to work. Although all the priests at Loyola wanted me to go to Loyola High School and coach football, I like, no, I'm going to Compton. So they kept me subbing for like a year and a half. And I was on the way trying to take over football program because I had been coaching a junior college ball for 4 years, you know, before I got to Compton. So anyway, Linwood would call me, offer me jobs, I turn them down. They called me the next day, raised the money. I turned them down. They called me a third time. I turned them down. So these two old sisters in the lounge said, boy, you need to go take that job. They said, we don't want to see you leave because you're one of the rare men around here. But, you know, you got a daughter. You need benefits. So I said, okay, I'm going to come. I went over and saw Linwood. It was about 55% Black, about 45% Latino at the time. So, you know, I go on and take the job, and Compton's calling me traitor and all this and that. But anyway, like I mentioned in some past shows, I was the first Black head coach in the history of the school. I was assistant for 8 years, listening to these little bitty white guys who never really even played football. They must have been on the B teams or something like that. But anyway,
PE teacher.
Yeah, they had their structure going and everything, and they were successful. But you know, they really weren't playing anybody. They played what I call a society of sisters. And so when I got the program, I tried to take it to another level. You know, we were playing like the top one or two team in the nation, you know, that kind of stuff, trying to take them to another level. Because we always get in the playoffs and we lose in the second round because we hadn't played nobody tough. But anyway, after they fired me, and that was done by Mickey Cureton by way of this assistant superintendent called Lavinia Steele, almost cussed her out and had to get, she wanted me gone. So I was going to the district office to let them know I'm leaving and this and that. So Audrey Clark calls me in. And she, you know, she had like an Ivy League background, that sort of thing. She like, Joe, are you sure you want to go there with them people? So I was going to Centennial. I said, well, I know it's crazy as hell over there, but at least they my people and I'm going to try to help. So I got on out of there because I had listened to a girl on this program. I don't know if you guys remember African Mental Liberation Weekend. They used to play a lot of lectures the first weekend of Black History Month. And so I heard the student on there that was from Centennial asking, plead for help. Can somebody come help them? Because nobody was teaching them nothing. So I took a $1,600 pay cut to take the job. So, and immediately got in there and and Brother Jesse Jones, who you never see with a tie on, and this is what he used to say about ties. He used to say, as many Black people that got hung in the United States, I refuse to wear a tie, because that's what it symbolized to him, okay? And I remember myself, after being a teacher, coach, went into administrator, got put back in the classroom from that, they called me back to get me back. And the first time they called me, I said, hell no, and hung up the phone. So the brother called me back a few minutes later, you know, pleading with me not to hang up. So he said, man, we got this principal that's requesting you. It was Miss Bynes. I don't know if you guys know, Jamea Bynes was on that national championship team with Cheryl Miller and them at USC. So I went to the interview in shorts, a La Tigre shirt, and some tennis shoes on. I refused to wear a suit. I didn't need the job. I really didn't give a hoot at the time whether they hired me or not, because I know in administration, you know, you got to dance to the music. I remember this old brother named Top Logan was a teacher at Centennial. He begged and pleaded with me not to go into administration. He said, man, he said, like, you're too much of a man and you got to dance to the music when you're an administrator. And he said, once you start polishing that knob, it ain't no stopping. That's the slogan he used to say. So after they let me go the first time, put me back in the classroom, I told him, like, Top, you was right. I said, but I never been over, and I never polished that knob. So anyway, I'm sitting in this interview for the second time when they were requesting me, dressed like I just mentioned. And that was Dr. Gonzalez was the superintendent, a Latino guy who had played basketball at New Mexico, him and get that other Laker. They kind of like integrated basketball down in New Mexico. They were in college. And I was bringing up to him about there's no hot water in the locker room in Compton Unified School District, and it's ridiculous. These athletes do all this practicing and can't take a hot shower. But anyway, he was saying, what can I bring to the situation to help out Centennial and this and that. I was like, man, I said, look, I can do the job. I ain't kissing no ass, though. I told him straight like that. If that's who you're looking for the wrong person, because I don't do that. And I said, the stuff I bring to the community, I know these kids. I know their parents. I said, I live here. I said, where do you live? I told him straight like that. So Ms. Bond almost busted up laughing when I said that in the interview. Then I went to a second interview dressed the same way. So, you know, you kind of gotta, if you want it and you're willing to sell enough of your self-esteem, Doc, to get the job, then you do it. But like myself, at that point, I didn't give a damn. So I wasn't bending over, I wasn't biting my tongue, because I knew, you know, what the job entailed, and I could handle it and straighten it out, but I refused to go along with anything. But when I was administrator, you know, I wore suits and whatnot. And I learned this from a brother, Kaleem Akil. He told me, the best way to calm an irate parent is to be real sharp, you know, suit and tie type thing. So I got that from him because I kind of refused to do that until he kind of worked on me a while. But anyway, all situations are different, like you say, Doc, and you have to measure it in terms of what you need compared to what you're willing to do. And that's the game. You know, you got to play the game to get through. I love the, what's that movie called? Higher Learning, when the brother says, was telling the young brother that he ain't learned the rules of the game. You got to know the rules of the game to finagle your way through. You know, and that's just how we got to be. We got to wear a lot of hats, so.
Yeah, but that's what Carmonack was saying all during the film, you know, his movie. Is that why do I have to change? Why do I have to, why do they make these rules? Or who made this rule? Remember that, Doc?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
He
makes that point. Correct.
Yeah, he made that a point. But what about this thing with Travis Scott in Astroworld, where 8 people died at this Houston concert? Black rapper, 50,000 people coming, and it looked like they going to make him a poster child of changing rules as for concerts and crowd control. Doc and Henry, any perspective on that before we get to Aubrey?
Well, I was looking at it on the news, and they were showing the crowd, and most of them look white.
They were.
The audience.
I was and like, Latino, white and Latino.
Okay, so, yeah, but I've heard in the past people getting crushed by crowds like that at concerts and soccer games around the world. You know, that'd be happening to folks. That's why I do not like crowds. And ever since...
They do that on Black Friday. Remember, all the stores open up late at night. Rush the doors.
Yeah.
And we used to have a rummage sale. Doc, I don't know if you remember rummage sales, but that's, you know, secondhand stuff our parents used to go buy for. And you had to get up early in the morning to get in front of the door. You go there that night before, the day before, to pick out the stuff you want. Then that morning, you know, you go and get there early. And then you rush in to go get the best stuff, secondhand stuff, and they call it a rummage sale. Now it's a little bit more orderly with these Goodwill stores and stores now, but in the old days, back in the 50s and coming up into the early 60s, they had rummage sale.
Call them Salvation Army stores now.
Yeah. You get tax right off the stuff. But anyway, in this, the doc, did you have any positions on this thing about Travis Scott? Should he be held responsible or?
You know, I'm gonna be honest, first of all, I didn't know who the hell Travis Scott was. I heard it. I'm thinking, isn't that somebody's name in country music? Something, and I'm thinking, wow, they having people dying at a country western music thing? And I didn't know it for about a day until I finally looked at the TV and they saw a young black kid there, man. But, you know, you just brought up another point. You know, on these Black Fridays at Walmart and Target, people get trampled, pressed, couples die, fights, shots, and no one sued Walmart. You know? And everybody's suing this guy and their promoters. To me, it's just one of those things. Like I said, I'm not into the music. I'm not into the concerts. So I'm pretty sure it happened before. I remember.
Yeah, he had it in
people, other people thing. Too. You know, yeah, other people. I know that Coachella thing. People overdosing, and you know, they're always suing the people who got the big pockets, man. But yeah, on this one, I have no clue who this kid is. I don't know. I don't think I know anything about his music. I'm not into concerts, so I will have to pass on this one.
What about you, Joe? What's your position on it?
I'm like, Doc, I never heard of the cat before. never heard of him. I was amazed to see that. I was thinking, like, Doc, he was a country western dude named like Travis. So, but I did hear on the news today that he's going to pay for all the funerals of the people that got killed. But, you know, you got them white folks all in the audience, so you know they're going to be pushing to sue somebody, if not him, the doggone promoter. Because I heard when the people died, they didn't even stop the show. They just kept on rolling along.
That's what they say. Well, I mean, you know, you're up there with lights in your face. You know, I've been a performer, so, it's hard to see what's going on in the crowd. But let me just say this. He also said he's going to pay for any psychological thing online for people that need counseling. Because some people said, I ain't never going to a crowd. Well, you ask the question, why would you go to a concert in a pandemic anyway? I know people want to get out, especially in Texas where you got open carry guns, you have no mask mandate, no vaccine mandate. And you're going to go to a concert? That raised the issue with me, you know, right there. Dre was there too. Is that the guy who'd be at the basketball games all the time? Dre? And he was one of the promoters, I think. But they do this every year. Last year, some people got crushed, but they didn't die. And it was only about 3 or 4. And they said the police met with him about his crowd because he sometimes edge him on. Performers like for people to rush the stage, don't get me wrong. This shows they love their audience, but this is a tragedy. We feel sorry for the died 14-year-old boy, some still in critical condition. And he's doing the best he can. But what they're doing is demonizing this young man as if, they say if he's one of the promoters, he could be held responsible. As a performer, he may not. But as a promoter, if he's one of the promoters of the show, they're going to hold him responsible for not having adequate security, not stopping the show on time. And those are the issues that he's faced with as far as that is concerned. But I think that it's wrong to characterize it. I think it's a two-way street, personally. The promoters and the audience that would rush a stage and crush other people. And the fight to get that close to a stage to see somebody sing. They had big screens. I don't know if they did, but I like to believe they did, and speakers, but people want to get up there. I went to a Funkadelic concert. I had to leave, it was too loud. And you never understood what they were saying. It's like in the Three Kings of Comedy when Steve Harvey talking about everybody got a mic. I don't know what the hell's saying, And but this guy is big in Houston because he's from Houston. And he puts on this concert every year. And it just got out of hand this year. 50,000 people after the pandemic wanted getting out and they participated in it. So we'll see how it plays out. Like Joe say and Doc say, they're gonna be suing and suing and suing. And they don't care if they got it, they just want some money now, big money from the insurance companies and from the artists. Settlements is as fast as they can get them. And it's gonna be a lot. Okay, anybody else have a comment?
Yeah, Rob, I want to just interject this. I used to work out in Anaheim, one of my former players. He begged me for the longest to come out there and help him do security. at this white club around the corner from Disneyland. I don't know if you ever witnessed a mosh pit before. When they go around in a like an oblong circle, and the faster the music go, the faster they go. And if somebody falls down, they get trampled and all of that. Well, I was in a little bitty building trying to keep that stuff from getting out of hand. And so this rushing the stage thing is nothing compared to that. They got some stuff what they call, I guess, sky surfing, where somebody get on the stage and jump off, and they carry them with their hands all through the crowd and all. So you know, rushing the stage is kind of mild-mannered as far as the Europeans go, but when you got them kind of numbers, stuff like that can happen just from the pressure of all of the people. But those doggone mosh pits is something else. I don't know if anybody ever witnessed one of them before, but, you know, I guess we don't party, you know, with the white folks. And they be doing karate-type moves, doing the mosh pit. I mean, it's crazy, man. And one night, we had a group, and the people on the stage performing wanted you to hark up and spit on them while they were performing. So, you know, them some crazy folks, man. So I don't put nothing past what they'll do at a show, especially a concert.
Well, after teams win World Series and win basketball championships and college teams beat, they rush the field all the time. And then they go out, you know, they have more people on the house, sometimes just me people on the outside watching on big screens. They start setting cars on fire, doing all kinds of stuff. That's why the word fan means fanatic. It's, you know, so, you know, it's a challenging thing, but still, when 8 people die, they want to hold somebody. They got what, 2 or 3 criminal investigations going, saying that somebody got stuck with a needle, and they had to revive them, and then they have just investigating that the whole aspect of, you know, why did the people rush the stage? They got the homicide and narcotics investigation going on. So we'll see how it go out. You know, it's too early to say, but they're gonna be going through it as much as they can. To try to blame on somebody. What about this Muhammad Aubrey case, Joe? How you feel about that?
It's rigged, man. It's already rigged. I was checking a little of it out today. It looks like the prosecutor is working for the defense. To me, stuff that's being said, and only got one black juror. But I was looking at that a little bit today. I got so sick of sound. So here we go again. So I just turned it off, man. But
and you was watching on HLN?
Yeah.
Okay. What about you, Doc? What about your position on
it? Same with Brother Joe. Yeah, I agree. I make up the jury. Even the judge came out and said something kind of on the side, so
right.
You know what? Yeah, just wait, see what happens, man. You never know. The jury come back and find the guys all guilty, and you know, we're shocked, and you know, they're all white and one black, and you know, just wait and see what happens. You know, well,
you got some major issues, though, Doc. I mean, I agree,
but you know,
the judge ruled that they can talk about the Confederate flag that was on their on their license plate. Second, they're arguing that it was self-defense, some of them, or one of them. Even though Audrey was jogging and he had no guns and he had no weapons and they were pursuing him, they still calling it self-defense.
the judge hasn't ruled that you can't use that as a defense yet. And that's why I think Joe and y'all feel that he may be rigged, because it seemed like a judge would say that's impossible because you thought he did something, not that you saw him do anything. You thought he looked like somebody that did some burglary in the area. So that's a challenge. But you know, we're on trial also as a people. You know, and you know, because they're dealing with stereotype perspectives, you know, to be able to even suggest that he posed a threat to them, and that there are two laws in Georgia. One, that the judge, as Doc said that he can't do anything about them getting rid of all the black jurors because they didn't use race, they just use that comments they made, and so he can't. But that's not true. You know, judges, that's why you have a judge to rule on issues like that. And if you, and the judge gonna say he felt that it was discrimination, he should have said, hey, no, we're gonna keep going, and I'm not gonna let you kick this person off. See the jury, I mean the defense, they have what they call exemplary things where they can get rid of a juror. But the judge can say, no, we're gonna keep them. They do it all the time. And so for him to sit there and let them kick all of them off and then say he can't do nothing is very suspicious. Second, he's saying that he's allowing them to argue a Georgia law that allows citizen arrest. I mean, you know, I mean, they didn't arrest him, they killed him. You know, and so that's a whole new different perspective with regards to that. This is a very interesting case because it's like Emmett Till. Emmett Till case was almost the same. They had an all-white jury that it just took them 30 minutes to find the white people who did it innocent, who beat him to death. And law enforcement was involved in it. So the point that I'm getting to say, you know, we as a people must become more conscious and concerned. A lot of people is like saying, yo, let's just wait and see. No, you got to be vigilant. They need to be demonstrating outside the courthouse now, saying, you know, the people in Georgia, they need to be demanding a fair trial. And a trial, not a fair trial, a fair trial with regards to the rulings from the judge, and because, you know, the judges can streamline, tell you, make the rules of the courtroom, and they give you jury instructions once the case is over with. And according to all of that, sometimes what they want to do is come up with any type of reason to get one juror to say, well, they may be innocent. And then that's a hung jury. Then you have to start all over again. So, you know, and people just look for a reason to vote the way they want to vote. If they're looking to vote guilty, they look for things that make them vote guilty. If they're looking for a way out, that's all attorneys want to do is give, throw all kind of stuff at the jury and hope one of them say, hey, that's good enough for me to vote no. So it's a struggle. And it's a continuous struggle for us as a people. All right, any other comments on the Aubrey case? What about you, Rasha Key?
Cold reality, basically. A cold reality. Shouldn't be no jury. They should straight be convicted without a jury. They were straight wrong, and it's just we're we're in an unfortunate situation. And so educate. You know,
well, what about this progressive movement that held up the legislation for the Build Back Better bill, wanting to link the infrastructure bill and the Build Back bill together? Most of that was led by the progressives, and many of them were Black. And they ended up conceding and separating the bills, and they're still haggling over the Build Back. Do you think that was a good strategy, Doc?
Once again, when it comes to politics nowadays, I don't follow none of this stuff. And, you know, it's not, never works out for us. So,
but you gotta fight.
You know, so I really never follow it. I know they passed whatever Biden was trying to do, but I've never seen anything so far to benefit us. It will never, you know, it trickles down. But I stopped following this stuff years ago because I never seen anything result, you know.
What about you, Joe?
Well, in the words of our ancestor now, Brother Kaleem Akil, when it comes to politics, truth ain't nothing but a word that rhymes with baby root. I'm kind of like Doc on that stuff. I don't know. I just want to piggyback back on the stage rushing thing and all of that and trying to sue. I don't hear none of them folks trying to sue Donald Trump after he sent all them folks into the Capitol building. You know? And what's up with that? You know, they locking a few people up, allegedly giving them 18 months, probably letting them out after 2 weeks. That sort of, and somebody died there too. So, you know, brother, I agree with you. People need to be out there protesting. I wonder where are these brothers at now, this group that was down there when it first happened, that NF, what is it called?
In fact.
Huh?
I think it's In Fact.
Yeah. The brother that was down there dressed up in the military garb and had their weapons and all that, they need to be outside the courthouse. Nah, you know, that's where they're in, down there in Georgia. One of them dropped a gun and shot and hit one of their own members, you know. But you gotta let the powers that be know that you gonna stand strong and be out there and be heard in order for them to take heed. That's the way it is. If they don't have nothing to fear, you know, from staying on that path, and they're gonna go down that path and just lock us up, kill us, do whatever they're gonna do. Like the old saying goes, it ain't no fun when the rabbit got the gun. You know, so like Brother Ross said, people need to be out there every day protesting. I haven't seen anything outside the courtroom. Do they have people out there that are protesting the situation? And what's the numbers look like? Anybody seen that? Brother Rob, doctor.
No, ain't no. They haven't focused on any demonstrations. I haven't seen Black Lives Matter, none of that. As far as getting news coverage. Now there may be some action going on. They're just not covering it. So you have to, probably have to call down there and talk to some of the groups and see what's going on. Because one of the things that they don't want to do is show stuff on television, then that make other people come out just to be on television. You know, and so they suppress Black activism because they know that causes people to get actively involved as soon as the cameras come on, you know, so. We'll see, but the issue is, as you point out, that we as have to have an overarching organization with the finances to sustain a movement, sustain activism. And it's not easy because you don't have the resources, you don't have the money, and you know, you don't, you know, it takes a lot of will, strong will to be a part of that, you know, and a lot of people don't want to do it. But that's the name of the struggle. You understand?
I wonder how many of them was out there after the Braves won the World Series.
So yeah, that's a good point. You know, that's a very good point. You know, and if it was enough of them out there, they would have got some coverage.
Oh yeah,
it may have been just a small group. You know, but that happens. The struggle is a long and continuous one. You need leadership. You need education, mobilization, organization, and then you can deal with some confrontation. But if you don't have those factors, you know, it's just what is called spontaneous reaction, spontaneity, you know, short term. Because as Doc would say, these things just gonna happen again and again. You should be prepared for it. And especially in Georgia, when they just are random centers. And then again, what people say when you're in Atlanta, once you leave Atlanta for Black people, you're in Georgia. And Georgia's a whole new different thing. I mean, see, it's easy for us in urban areas to talk. But them brothers and sisters down there in the South, it's a whole new different game. You know, the justice, I mean, the penitentiary time they give them. The person that got the longest time for the insurrection is a Black dude, not the white dude. And he didn't even go to the rally. He just posted stuff. They gave him 14 months. And no one else had gotten a 14-month sentence in that insurrection yet. You know, he's the one who got the longest sentence. So, you know, we as a people.
He should have got more time. He should have got life. Been down there with the white dude, boys.
Well, look at the sister in Virginia who won the lieutenant governor. Her name is Sears. She's from Jamaica. She said, "I'm not a victim. I don't believe in teaching Black history, and I don't believe that." And she loved Donald Trump. She embraced Donald Trump. She organized Blacks for Trump in Virginia, and I mean, just a way out sister, man. And she got elected, and she praising America, talking about, where could a person from Jamaica come and from humble beginnings, and now I'm the most second powerfulest person in Virginia statewide, lieutenant governor? Wow. Yeah. You know, and look at Clarence Thomas.
Can you be a
Supreme Court justice for Thomas?
Hey, Rob.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the concept of the turncoat?
well, there's a lot of them, you know. You know, sometimes, as Martin Luther King said, even if you're not acting, if you're not participating, you can in complicity. It's not the anger of the people out there, it's the silence of your friends that allows them others to be strong. But the stronger we are, the more people stand up. You know, but yeah, you know, so I got to get back into that perspective about turncoats. We have a lot of them. It's big money in Uncle Tommy. It's big money. I'm talking about big, big rewards that you can get. And that's for all groups. It's not just us, you know. But Uncle Tom, the original Uncle Tom, was rebellious. You understand? When you look at the history of the word Uncle Tom, then they turned it, they demonized it and turned it into turncoats and sellouts. But the original Uncle Tom was a radical, you know, and but most people don't know that history of that term. And so we have to look that up, and I'm pretty sure Joe, from a historical perspective, will have some perspective on it when you get a chance. But let's just go this last comment about should Irving get the shot or not get the shot? From that standpoint of the money he's losing, and his position is that, you know, he just don't think he you know, he has the right to refuse the shot and just take the test out, you know, just do the testing. What do you think, Doc?
Yeah, you know what? I think it's an individual choice. I agree with you, man. Man, if you don't want to take it, don't take it. You know, didn't Ice Cube just turn down something?
Yeah.
He turned down millions of dollars because he didn't want to take the shot, you know. It's kind of like you said earlier. Kind of, like you said earlier, Rock, you got the money. You didn't need that job. You know, hey, the Cube don't need the, he don't need that movie deal. I don't think he, you know, hopefully he has his money saved up. So he don't need to play. He should have millions. Mm-hmm. So when you're in that position, just like the, you see how bad you did him, and no one's saying anything about Rodgers, right? The Green Bay quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's really saying nothing negative about him. He's not been thrown under the bus. They said, oh, you know, they kind of trying to sweep that under the rug now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but hey, I think it's all the individual choice, man. He's doing the right thing for himself and his family. When his career is over, he'll be a memory. He'll be sitting somewhere with bad knees, bad back, probably no one talking, you know, to him. All them friends are gone, and he, you know, it's just going to be him.
But the argument, Doc, is that it's a communal disease. So it's not just about you. It's about your family, your friends, people around you, and people you work with. Yeah, if you're going to not take the shot, then there's some protocols and, you know, wearing the mask and you know, certain things, because like Rodgers thought he could get away with, because he didn't think he would ever get it, following these people's things, and he got it. It's a communal disease. And so when you don't get it, get the shot or vaccine, and you don't go by the rules of the league or the state. It's not the league, it's the state saying that you can't play in the arena or participate in group activities unless you're vaccinated. He chose not to, but that raised the issue that should he be allowed to play not vaccinated? The other players are, but he's not, you know. That raised a calamity. What about you, Joe? What's your position on?
Man, I don't understand Kyrie Irving at all. He's like Chinese arithmetic to me. Every time I hear him in an interview, you know, he says some bizarre stuff like people still believe the world is flat and all this old kind of stuff. So, but you know, he's primarily the reason those brothers are there in the first place. What's the other brother's name?
Durant.
And the left-hand shooting brother from L.A.
From Houston, yeah.
Yeah, he's from here, though. What's his name? With the beard.
Harden.
Yeah. So, you know, you're gonna assemble this group. And I beg to differ. Like on First Take, those shows, they've been tearing
Rodgers up
today, and ever since it happened, because say, you know, he's a liar. He wasn't truthful and whatnot. And it was funny that somebody said today, so you've been taking medication from doctors your whole life. You ain't asked about no research on that. You know, you ain't doing your due diligence on, you know, what's in that.
A lot of people follow that Christian Science, like the Nation of Islam was involved with Christian Science. Hubbard, was that Hubbard?
Christian Science.
You know, it blew our mind that the Nation would get that deep involved with them. And, you know, they pushed non-vaccine. And so it's a question of, I'm like you, Joe. It's perplexed to me that, if you don't want to get the shot, then you deal with the consequences. You understand? If all the other players that's playing is getting a shot, then, you know, I don't understand. What about you, Rasha Key? I know your position on shots, period, but, you know, what do you think about this?
Well, hey, brother got to do what he got to do for himself. And the thing about it is, you know, we get all of this information from the main media as if we could trust them. How can you just keep going with what they say and think that it's okay? I can't tell. I keep telling you, we talk about this every now and again. I can't think none of they worth anything that they say. And a lot of this stuff is coming from the popular media. And then you could catch the virus if you vaccinated or not. So it's so many contradictions, you know, so I can't even talk about it because I think the way I think and other people think the way they think. So I'm not going to bend with the way I think. I don't do that. I don't bend. I'm like Colin Kaepernick. Hey, I'm going to play quarterback and I don't care nothing about no baseball contract, you know? So it's to each their own. I don't trust them. Never did and never will.
Well, it's not the media. Black doctors and black.
Yeah, but black doctors sell out too.
But we're not all of them. You can't say all of them. My point is that once you take a position that you're not going to do it, that's fine. I have no problem with it. I got a daughter who won't take the shot. So I understand. You understand that that's what they is, but you deal with the consequences, you know, and you deal with the challenge. And a lot of people that didn't take the shot, who got it, and really got real sick, was saying that they wish they had it because they didn't know it was this bad. So,
and Rob,
are you saying people, that you don't believe in the people, shot, or you don't believe that the disease?
No, which one you got people believe? that's on the other side of that. They say they got the shot, and they say they shouldn't have got the shot.
There's I ain't people seen that.
Well, mm-hmm. I have. I have. So, you know, it's, man, that's why I don't like talking about it, because it's not a conversation for me.
Yeah.
It's not a conversation for me.
I have a question with Brother. Is Compton Unified requiring teachers to get shots?
You got to get tested. Or you have to have a shot.
Okay. So I
don't talk about it at all.
How often are they testing you?
I don't talk about it.
Well, I agree. If you don't want to do it, don't do it.
I don't talk about it. It's not for me to talk about. I'll let you guys discuss that. I'm gonna listen.
Yeah. Well, hey, look here, let's get ready for next week. Who's on Wednesday?
We got Sister J-Dub. She's been on, we call her Miss J-Dub. She's been on, this will probably be her third visit.
What's she going to talk?
The topic, you know, the topic is interesting. Let me pull it up because we discussed it And it's interesting, and she's gonna discuss it. It's gonna be like a roundtable discussion.
Okay.
But I'll show it so everybody can see it. Cultivating our curiosity for those who work in the system. So that should be very interesting. And we're gonna do a round table. She's just gonna open up with discussing it. And then we're gonna go around the panel and talk about it.
For those that work in the system?
Yeah. Yeah. So and when we were talking about it, it seemed to be pretty interesting. You know, she's saying basically, how can you keep what you want to do while working in the system and, you know, and cultivate it.
Like entrepreneurship?
Just your ideas, your visions. But she's gonna open up discussing her point, and then we're gonna discuss it.
All right, well, next week, I think, which one did I say was coming on the 15th? I told you.
I think Kaumba is coming on first.
And I'm in the 29th on economics.
Yeah. As soon as you give me the final word, we can post it.
Okay, then. I'll give it to you tomorrow.
Okay.
All right, everybody. Thanks, Doc. Doc, thanks for your deep thought. Thanks, Brother Hembrick, for your deep thoughts. And thanks, everyone who will view this on YouTube. And thank Brother Roger Key for his deep thought in getting this program and this platform together. Interaction, loved every minute of it. Thank everybody, and we'll see you Wednesday, hopefully. All right.
All right, thank you. Each one teach one.
All right.
Conscious Corner.
Okay.